So as we come to the end of our study of the wisdom literature, we come to the Song of Songs, sometimes known as the Song of Solomon. It's a book that many are not familiar with. And on a surface reading, it's a story. It's a story told in poetry of the deep and intimate love between a man and a woman. It's explicit, it's sometimes erotic, and it uses powerful picture language to describe how each person in the relationship sees the other. It's so explicit that in much of the history of Judaism, it was included on the short list of passages that the young and immature were forbidden to read. At one level, it's a collection of love poems, but there have been many attempts to find a deeper meaning. Some people saw it as a love song between Israel and her God, expressing the intimacy between them in terms associated with human marriage. People looked at that in the Christian era and extended that to speak about it being a love song between Christ and his church. And this was extended to refer to the love between Christ and each individual believer. It's attracted interest for centuries. There was a medieval monk named Bernard of Clairvaux who preached 86 sermons on the Song of Solomon between 1135 and when he died in 1153. And he'd only reached the beginning of chapter 3. He had a lot to say about this book. And if you want to, you can go online and read the complete text of all that Bernard had to say about it. Remember we looked at the book of Job, we looked at the book of Ecclesiastes. And some suggest that this book, Song of Songs, explores the mystery of love, where Job explores the mystery of suffering, Ecclesiastes the mystery of existence. It's trying, they together are trying to give some insight into some of the big questions of life. What do we mean by, what do we understand by suffering? What is the point of life? How do we understand this thing that we call love? We could look at it in many different ways, but this evening I want us to think about it as a commentary, as God's perspective on human marriage. And I want to suggest that it reflects in more detail than any other portion of Scripture on God's initial plan for man and woman to live together in marriage. If you go back to Genesis 2, that is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife and they become one flesh. A story of Adam and Eve coming together, becoming that first married couple that we find in the story of the Bible. And I think this book picks up those simple phrases there and expands on them and gives us real insight and understanding into what it means, into this relationship that God has designed between a man and a woman. What can this song teach us? What does it have to say to us today? As I said, it's a book of powerful imagery, and I think as you read it and as you look at it carefully, you find that there's a central point in the story. And that central point is what Peter read to us earlier. This is where the man and the woman come together and are married. We find the groom speaking about his bride. "You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride." It starts. This word bride only appears 6 times in this book, between verse 8 of chapter 4 and verse 1 of chapter 5. And it suggests that at this point in the story, we're actually seeing the wedding between these two people. So obviously before that, there's the build-up to that. There's the start and the development of a relationship. Afterwards, there's some insight into what it means to live as a married couple. In verse 12 of what Peter read, The groom speaks of his bride as being a garden locked up. Whereas by the time we get to the end of that passage, the garden is open. The groom is there with his bride. And it's as though that is the moment at the culmination of their wedding that the relationship between them is consummated, with a strong indication this is the first time that they have slept together. So if that is what is going on in this central part of the book, what is going on either side of it? And as we think about that, as we see how the relationship develops and grows and experiences difficulty, let's think about how much of what it says provides guidance on these hugely important relationships, how it speaks about things to rejoice in and things to look out for. And I want to suggest that these are the things that we still need to look out for, we still need to rejoice in, we still need to guard against. If we go right back to the beginning of the book, we're introduced to the couple. And they speak powerful words of love and desire for each other. They've noticed each other, and they're starting to recognise that there's something between them. The first words that the woman speaks in verse 2 makes clear her deep desire for this man, her longing to be with him, how he's becoming so important in her life. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. She wants to be close to him. She finds more pleasure in being with him than anything else. And he responds with words that speak of his admiration for her beauty. In verse 8, he refers to her as the most beautiful of women. In verse 15, how beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful. Your eyes are doves. Apparently that's a good thing. Verse 16, he responds. They continue as she responds to him. How handsome you are, my beloved. And they speak about a verdant bed. I had to look verdant up. I had no idea what it meant. Apparently it talks about greenery and leaves and twigs and branches and stuff like that. I'm sure there's people here who know that already. Suggesting the idea they're out camping somewhere in a forest. They're just enjoying time together. They're starting to get to know each other. They're saying how much they appreciate each other. There's a spark developing between them. They enjoy and long for each other's company. And then from verse 8 in chapter 2 to verse 5 in chapter 3, the relationship deepens. And they realise that they need each other. They need to be together. But we get the sense that there are things to be sorted out. In chapter 2, verse 8 and 9, we find that the man comes to see the woman. And there's a reference to the winter being past, maybe suggesting that they have been apart for some time. And so they're coming together again. They're being reunited. And he comes and he encourages her to come out with him and to see the wonders of nature. So in verse 10, as she speaks and says that my beloved spoke and said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, come with me. But it seems she didn't immediately respond, as he needs to repeat the invitation in verse 13. She's quiet. She doesn't seem as keen as he would have liked to come out and to spend time with him. And so in verse 14, he encourages her to speak. Show me your face. Let me hear your voice. There's a reluctance that we're getting a sense of, suggesting that maybe there is something between them, something that is getting in the way of their relationship. And the closest we get to understanding what that is in verse 15, where it says, catch for us the foxes, the little foxes, that ruin the vineyards. And there's lots of debate over what that means. But it's as though there's something that is damaging a vineyard, but in the poetry that's being used here, it's damaging their relationship. Something that has come between them that needs to be resolved and needs to be restored. We aren't told what the specific problem is, But it's something that needs to be dealt with before they can move forward. And it's important to get this sorted because they've started to realise their relationship is getting serious. Things need to be dealt with if they're going to have any chance to continue in the long term. But even though we're not told what the problem is, it looks as though the issue is resolved as the woman speaks next in verse 16 about the confidence that they are each other's. My beloved is mine and I am his. There's no one else. They're becoming more and more committed to each other. And if that is the resolution, it's possible that she was concerned that there was somebody else in his life and that she wanted to know that he was totally committed to her. And it seems that that has been resolved. So doubts are behind them and that they can look ahead to a future together. But that had to be sorted to allow them to move on. And then we move into chapter 3, verse 6 to 4, 15, where we're preparing for the wedding. The groom arrives. And he spends time telling his bride how beautiful she is. They've reached that point of commitment where they want to make that public statement to the world that they are choosing to become one. Solomon is identified as the groom. He appears on a fine carriage accompanied by 60 of his finest warriors. It's wonderful to look at. He's wearing a fine crown. Everything is splendid. Maybe slightly ornate than many of the weddings we've been to. But there are days when you try and make an effort to be the best that we can. But even in all his splendour, even surrounded by his private army, his thoughts and attention is focused on the woman he's about to marry. And once again, he tells her how special she is to him, using language that might not quite work today. Verse 2, your teeth are like a flock of sheep, just shorn. Hey, I think he was saying he really loved her smile. Then he goes on in verse 3, your lips are like a scarlet ribbon, your mouth is lovely, your temples behind your veil. It's interesting that all of those things that he's just referred to, her lips, her mouth, her temples, would be behind a veil. She was getting married. In that day, the custom was the woman would be veiled. And it's as though he's able to say what he does because her appearance is burned into his mind. He knows what she looks like. He doesn't need to see. He's infatuated with her. He longs for her to become his wife. And then the bride responds, part of what Peter read to us. She accepts her groom. They are married and everyone is invited to come together to celebrate with a party. This is the central point of the story. They've become close. Their love has deepened. They've recognised they want to live their lives together. They've sorted out the issues that were between them. And this is the point where they make that public commitment and enter into that deeply private and intimate relationship. But it's interesting the story doesn't end there. While the wedding is wonderful, they need to work out what it means to live as a married couple. And one of the problems I see today is how many couples forget that. They focus on making sure the wedding is perfect, but don't spend time thinking through what living together as a couple will really mean. And here we see that while they do continue to have a deep love for each other, there are problems and tensions creeping into their relationship. In chapter 5, verse 2, the man knocks on the door asking to be let in. It's night time. He's obviously been out somewhere. She's at home. She's in bed. And she doesn't want to get up to let him in. You'd have thought he'd have a key, but hey. She doesn't want to get up to let him in. And then she has second thoughts, and she does get up, and she goes to the door, but he's gone. And she realises that he's gone off, and she's alone, and she's in desperate need to see him. She goes out into the city to try and find him. And just for that moment, her comfort and her desire for sleep outweighed her willingness to go and let her husband in. And then he was gone. It was a passing moment. And their love and desire for each other is very real. And over the next couple of chapters, they continue to speak passionately and positively about the other. There is reconciliation going on. But the question being asked here is, how will their real love for each other work itself out in the reality of daily living? And then from 7:11 onwards, they are reunited. And she encourages him to go away for a break. Come, my beloved, let us go to the countryside. Let us spend the night in the villages. She wants them to get reunited, to restore their relationship. And sometimes that is necessary. To take time away from the pressure of everyday life, from all the things that come upon us. And to take time away, just the two of you. To leave everyone else behind, to focus on each other, to remind themselves why they fell in love in the first place. How important they are to each other. And as we come to the end of the story, we're left asking the question as to how this relationship will end. As they return from their time away, the woman turns to her husband and restates her deep love for him and asks him to keep her at the centre of his life and affections. In chapter 8, verse 6, she speaks and says, "Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. Its jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame." She wants him for herself. She wants to know that he feels the same way. But she knows there are other women around who are interested in him. She wants his assurance that he is committed fully and totally to her. But sadly, there's no response from her husband. And we are left wondering how this marriage will develop, what problems and challenges still await them. So I suggest again, this is an outworking, a detailed account of something of what it means, in the words of Genesis 2, for a man and woman to publicly commit themselves to each other. And we see this pattern worked out time and time again. Boy meets girl, fall in love, get married, live in relationship together. There's a growing awareness of the other, a desire to be together, a deepening of relationship. But we also see many situations where this doesn't work out. Couples choose to take that step of sexual intimacy before that public commitment to each other in marriage. Couples think that the first flush of love is sufficient to keep their marriage strong without realising it's something to be worked at and issues need to be addressed. And so they allow things to come in that will damage that relationship and don't respond to their partner when issues are raised that need to be worked through. These and similar things have been problems for centuries. And this song speaks of the reality of these things and encourages couples to adopt a wise approach to living and developing together. How do these things apply to us, hundreds of years later, in a different context, but with a story that is amazingly familiar? I think it depends on where we are on that particular journey. When people start this type of relationship, it raises important questions to think about. Yes, there is that love, there is that desire, there is that attraction. But are there issues that need to be sorted out before that can go forward? If we are living within a marriage relationship, it reminds us of the importance of preserving and protecting time for each other and to ensure that issues are addressed as they arise. If we aren't in that relationship at this time, maybe our partner having died or left us, then we can look back on the times we shared together and rejoice in that. And when any of us have the opportunity to counsel and advise couples on their journey together, the principles and questions outlined in this song are important to bear in mind. For so many, ignoring these things result in the failure of their marriage. And here we have something of God's wisdom to speak into those situations and to try to help and sustain. This is God's plan for a man and a woman to live together. And this story, this song, tells of some of the joys, of some of the pressures, some of the delights, some of the issues in making that a reality. It was important in the days of Adam and Eve. It was important in the days of Solomon as we reflect on this song. It was important in the time of Jesus. Jesus was asked a question about divorce, and he chose to respond to that by reminding people of that creation ideal, of God's plan in Mark 10. He says to those who were talking to him, "At the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh." It was there in Genesis. It was there in the Song of Solomon. It's picked up by Jesus. Picked up elsewhere in the Bible. This is a central theme of how relationships are designed to work. They continue to be important today, even when our society would say they are outmoded, old-fashioned, and of no relevance whatsoever. But this is still God's plan for how men and women can live together in harmony and relationship. And I want to suggest that the lessons of this book can help us work out something of the reality of what is involved in making that marriage relationship flourish. Can help the couple to enter into some of the deeper blessings that God has in store for them, and to enable the couple to be a blessing to others. It's a strange book. It's a fascinating book. It takes work to try and get to understand what it's really trying to tell us. But I think it has huge value for people today as they try and recognise some of the challenges of living in this married relationship together. It recognises the importance of love. It recognises the reality that there will be tension, there will be difficulties that need to be addressed, and the importance of addressing them. It recognises the need to take time for each other, to care for each other. And it talks about the importance of commitment and the importance of staying committed to each other. Hugely, hugely important for us to be aware of and to think about and to work out in our lives and in our relationships today.